In the next 30 minutes or so, what I'd like to try doing, since this is a very large topic, is providing you a background and then some salient examples of how recent advances in algorithms and tools based on such algorithms can realize the potential for image-based search. That is the goal of using not just text-based repositories, as is the practice in our current LIS and APIS systems to retrieve information, but shifting the predicate from text to the images themselves as a way of enhancing our practice model. If we look at the history of imaging in general, and specifically digital imaging, there was a revolution and renaissance in this technology in the 60s and then 70s, fueled by the Cold War, with this perhaps being one of the groundbreaking images of Lop Nur, which was one of the first sites of a nuclear test detonation. And, of course, algorithms were designed to identify this signature type of image. Obviously, images would come from satellite acquisition data sets without being annotated. You just had the raw data. And there was the need to identify from these vast data sets quickly specific types of strategic intelligence. And thus was born the notion of automated feature extraction or image query. Thus, the predicate of search would be something that looked like a ground zero type fingerprint. Fueling, of course, the technology and empowerment of digital pathology is the CCD, or charge-coupled device. With this fundamental transforming technology, it has become possible to acquire images of unprecedented quality and resolution, making it possible to shift from diagnosis by microscope to diagnosis by a computer screen. If we look at the topology of our current information systems and how we anticipate that they will evolve in the next perhaps 5 to 10 years, the typical AP-LIS system now across AP and CP aspects has a far preponderance of text-based storage and metadata with maybe a tiny slice. And, of course, I realize that a number of your sites may have a larger contingent of imagery, but this imagery is, in fact, static from the perspective of being available for query. If it is queryable, it's queryable only by virtue of the fact that it's associated with some text that makes it available for discovery. As this practice changes, though, as we see, in fact, greater dependence on storage of the gross and microscopic images, this ratio is going to shift. And in time, because we know that images occupy much more storage than text, eventually this ratio will become inverted, and the far majority of many of our information systems, if we capture images at all, will see that the actual absolute value of bytes stored will be completely occupied or dominated by imagery and not the text. So this leads us to the basic notion, what are the compelling use cases for image query? And I say this because obviously just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do so. John Sinard and I have done for several years, and we'll do again in fall for the CAP meeting, a point-counterpoint on whether telepathology and the use of digital pathology will actually emerge in the near future. And he has traditionally taken the points against the con, and I've taken the pro perspective. And he has actually some very compelling slides why this won't happen, specifically that just because you can do it, there's no compelling driver. And without the presence of a compelling driver, there's really no point to spend all the expenditure of infrastructure, resources, and time to deploy imaging, except his last slide makes the very obvious realization that if the digital imaging provides something diagnostically additional or something that enhances the practice model, then the scales are turned, and then digital imaging becomes not only compelling, but becomes really the new gold standard. And that key element that both he and I agree is diagnostic decision support. If by having the images in a repository available to you, in concert with your current digital images, that provides you something enhanced that ultimately equates to enhanced patient care, enhanced productivity, and then these other things, longitudinal evaluation, certainly from my perspective in the past of doing many, many evaluations of liver disease, chronic hepatitis, longitudinal evaluation is paramount, differential diagnosis generation, detection of rare events, and certainly teaching, and in scientific discovery. All these are compelling drivers, with perhaps diagnostic decision support being one of the most important of those. Turning the tides and our attention just briefly to an additional set of circumstances which are before us now, that constitute the overwhelming availability of these massive multidimensional data sets, as was already discussed on the first day of the plenary session, we not only have the potential for massive data sets from the imagery that we can capture now with whole slide imaging, we're seeing that from the proteomics data, from the genomics data. One of the collaborating groups I work with in Boston, looking at inflammation and a network-based approach, can generate in a simple time series study of one or two patients 100 million vectors per time point with upwards of 10 time points. So pushing a billion vectors of information per study. And this is a clinical study with a simple question being, how does the inflammatory response in a patient who's severely injured change over time from initial presentation to later periods during their hospitalization? So if this is a static vector at one point in time, it can be viewed in a method which is not very intuitive, or it can be grouped together in a so-called interactome where vectors are clustered based on their corresponding similarity or nearness. And this is still overwhelming to you or I, but it constitutes an opportunity for identification of patterns which constitute a physiologic state. Again, patterns then in each one of those interactomes can be drilled down to individual portions of the metabolic pathways. Drilling down further, you can now localize these to the cell level biochemically, knowing where particular receptors or proteins live in the cytoplasm or nucleus. And then ultimately, this can be correlated with histology. So as we look for time series data, we have various areas which are part of the metabolic pathway which may have physical correlates in the spatial domain of histopathology. So you can see where I'm heading with this is synthetic potential data sets that combine proteomics, genomics, and morphology. Thus, it is anticipated that in some instances, the morphology itself may be a predicate for the underlying metabolic data. And that's just to sort of set up for what we have now in our current world model and why it's inadequate for addressing the need for these multidimensional systems. If we look at the current relational database model, in those instances where we have imaging, and in fact, not every database has imaging, and that's appropriate, we find that we have the case-based, perhaps some places are patient-based, but mostly we have an accession-based model, and any associated metadata is tied onto this text, again, more text, and then images are simply appended onto the record in such a fashion that if you wish to search for these images, you do so by going through the text-based information. Another common approach in some image-based databases is to have the text-based metadata appended to each respective image. Again, though, the predicate for query is the text and not the image itself. And thus, if there is some feature in any one image that has not been previously adjudicated and characterized with the metadata, it will not be available for discovery by the text. And this is the fundamental limitation of current image repositories. They are only as good as the quality of the metadata appended to each respective image. And this is a significant limitation. A possible and highly desirable future worldview would change the model by which images are queried, based now, you see, not on text, but a simple region of interest, which then can be queried as an element of or possible element of your repository, where in a sense you have a, for a little literal description, a sliding window where you'd say, does this look like this? Does this look like this? And slide it through all the sections of all the images you have and see if you have a match. Unfortunately, that literal comparison doesn't work because things are never exactly the same. Plus, even to do some type of approximative query ends up in a circumstance which is computationally prohibitive. And hence, this is the fundamental reason why conventional image-based search has not been germane or helpful for histopathology. The fact is, the size of the data sets is very large and constitutes a computationally challenge or what in computer science is commonly called a non-trivial problem. So if we look at the potential or for even increased sizes in data sets, looking at the proteomics genomics world colliding with just the sheer volume of data we already generate or potentially could generate with whole slide imaging and pathology, we see an increased size of the global composite vectors, and they're composite because they represent spatial information in the microscopic continuum, as well as expression data and genomic data. This added data certainly adds to the complexity of analysis, but at the same time, it adds to opportunity for discovery. The impediments to this are the fact that, for the most part, there's no commercial software. There's really a paucity of synthetic algorithms that are applied to this multimodal type of data, and there are very few domain-specific publications, with a lot of the publications to date coming from this gentleman right next to me. So you've got a pretty good crowd here today. So when I first suggested to several of my engineering colleagues that I wanted to go through hundreds of terabytes of data in real time looking for information that would be a decision support tool, they told me I was nuts. And, of course, this is a famous portrait of Salvador Dali, with him known to say, the difference between myself and a madman is obviously I am not mad. And I hope at the end of this session I'll prove to you I'm not too mad. So if we look at a typical data set that might be arrived to from a whole slide image, we see that if we had the entire surface area occupied, 2.5 by 7.5 centimeters, and acquired the image at the diffraction-limited resolution of light, which is about a quarter micron, we see that in raw data, perhaps we have 20 megapixels of data, 20,000 megapixels of data. And then this, of course, is the same thing of saying we have 20,000 images that are 1,000 by 1,000. And then if you look at the size of this data set compared to perhaps something typical like a chest X-ray, which is 4 megapixels, you can see that a single slide and a single plane of focus represents a significantly larger potential or area for query. This is compounded by the fact that you can sometimes acquire as many as 10 or 15 planes of separate focus. And, of course, the reality is you can acquire information in three color planes, which is RGB, which then multiply each location by 3. Or more recently, you can acquire it by as many as 28 or 30 different planes. And I'll show that to you now as an example. And that means, of course, that your data set size just went up by a factor of 28 or 30. And that's more space to be. So we have this application. As I move around, obviously white space is white. This is luminance, so you'd expect a flat line. However, if I go over a particular, this is an eosinophil. We have a very characteristic vector. So these are wavelengths. And in real time now, you can see I have, in this particular data set, 14 separate wavelengths. And different cells, different stains, have different unique wavelengths, which then is two things: added complexity, you have to store it all, but at the same time, added opportunity for differentiation of information. So just because something looks blue to you, or two different things look blue to you, when you combine them in hyperspectral space, they may be very, very different. Again, the limitation of the human optical system, which simply has three flavors or categories of cones, the red class, the green, and the blue class, where light itself, of course, is a continuum. And I simply show this to underscore or highlight the problem with increasing size of dimensionality and the need for algorithms that can tame this dimensionality. So the project that I undertook about 4 years ago now, which is an ongoing project, is to develop a self-training set of tools that would provide for image segmentation and classification and ultimately image retrieval, that, basically underscoring the need for query by example. And not necessarily just the image search space, but combined then with a morphologic proteomic genomic search space, and specifically not text-based. And then looking at ways of reducing the complexity to make this possible. Because as I mentioned, the notion of storing and then searching the image space in the raw data fashion would be impossible computationally. There's not enough computational power in most people's institutions even to address the problem without some type of numerical approach that simplifies. The first of two algorithms, and I'll mention this very briefly, that enable this are vector quantization. The next algorithm, which I'll go over as well, is Galois field transformation. The notion of vector quantization is that domains of an image can be constrained and then reduced down to simple local domains, which then can be queried for uniqueness. And that is to say, If you have an area of an image that looks generally like a pattern, you can identify the generalities of that pattern and then represent that entire pattern by a single number or placeholder, also known as an address. So what is a vector? If we look at an image, this is an image of adenocarcinoma of the prostate, for example, a little square of this necrotic area constitutes a family of pixels. Obviously, it's blurred because I've greatly expanded this, but all these pixels constitute a family or one vector. Numerically, what does that look like? It looks like a x by y vector. This could, of course, be n-dimensional. I've given you the simplest case, which is x by y, where each one of these locations represents the luminance or optical density values. All the vectors together constitute the overall kernel. The interesting thing about this, of course, is this vector now can be further reduced by a so-called Galois field to a canonical vector, which then represents the theoretical optimal or best matched vector, which then is simply nothing more than a number. This is vector 12, this is vector 200, this is vector 300 million. And the beauty of this algorithm is that there's no bound to the number of vectors you can collect. And as you collect them, you can classify them as to what they represent. So one vector can be adenocarcinoma, one vector can be necrosis, and you generate then one vector, families of vectors, and then entire libraries of vectors based on diagnoses. So you can see the work associated with this is simply building the vectors. So when we look at the higher order data sets that constitute vectors, multiplanar, in other words, multiple focus, we have synthetic data sets, which could be image genome, image proteome, image physiome, and then hyperspectral, as I've already showed you a simple example. And again, all these disparate systems can be glued together to make an even larger family of composite vectors. Again, the algorithm itself does not care whether a vector comes from image space or from the expression profiling space. It's simply a number. And numbers in groups have causality or they may not have causality. And that's what needs to be explored from a stochastic perspective. So from a vector analysis perspective, added vectors simply add robustness. So this is an opportunity. It should be looked at as a good thing. And it's really irrelevant whether or not they have or do not have independent phenomenological underpinnings. So it's okay to combine apples and oranges in the realm of vector quantization. Just as a simple example of what happens when one strives to reduce complexity, if we look at an example of a polynomial which has been fit to some Z data, and representing, I think in this case, multiple focal planes, we have here 18 focal planes, but at the same time, this is not necessarily satisfactory from a model representation. This can be, as you see, fit to a Chebyshev polynomial with three terms representing a significant compression ratio. Now, instead of having 18 values, I have three values. And you can see at any given point the deviation between the original value and the modeled value is quite small. As a matter of fact, it's so small that if you were to look at it with your eye in terms of one pixel versus the other's brightness, you would not be able to see a difference. So a key point of all these algorithms is that with their original intent being for compression, they do change the data, but they don't necessarily damage the data. They actually compress the search space required, creating opportunity for search. The Galois fields, and I won't go into the detail of how these operate other than to show you they are quite complex, serve to aggregate and coalesce families of vectors from simply being an address, like this is vector 200,345,000 and so forth, and this is vector 1. The Galois field creates a way of mapping these in N space. So as I show you in a little while, Voronoi diagrams, which are like throwing darts on a dartboard and they cluster, the Galois fields tell you how to cluster things logically that simplify statistical evaluation. And so if you were to project a Galois field on a two-dimensional space, again, remembering these are really n-dimensional systems, for simplified visualization, you have centroids where these particular vectors aggregate. And thus, any vector in this region constitutes a unique diagnostic entity or a unique spatial or configurational entity. And it really is, this algorithm is agnostic to whether or not this constitutes just spatial information from histopathology or combined information from genomics, proteomics, and histopathology. Again, the algorithm simply looks at the statistical clustering and patterning of the information. So tying it all together, if this is a local region of interest within an image, As it is dissected apart, there's a simple process where it's queried against the vocabulary. If that particular region matches out by the Galois transformation, which speeds up matching it to the vocabulary, it says, aha, I've seen this before, and it says this is the number representing this vector. However, if it's a novel vector, meaning I haven't seen this before, and this is in training mode, it says this is novel, we need to keep this, and it adds it into the vocabulary with its new address and then puts it into the table as well. Originally, this was very useful for compression and decompression of images, but it turns out it has a more valuable and actually far more valuable impact, and that is to say if you look at the compression, where it's small and large, and decompression cycle, this is an interesting area because now these numbers represent spatial tokens for the larger image. But a key element of these smaller spatial tokens is they're organized in n space via the use of the Galois transformation, so they represent unique vectors. And more importantly, this is a small fraction of the original data. So from a computational perspective, searching this is computationally very attractive. Searching this is computationally intractable. So the opportunity of looking at a smaller search space is really the underlying etiology for why vector quantization with Galois field works. If we look at the statistical underpinnings of why this is effective, we need only look to the Boltzmann distribution, which is a way of modeling stochastic processes. And as we see with the Boltzmann distribution, we can model many discrete elements in a continuous fashion using computational statistics. And what this shows us from a conceptual perspective is that it is from a statistical perspective, acceptable to model these vectors in a Galois field and look at the highly abbreviated space as a predicate for the original images. I really don't want to go into this too much more, other than to say its origin is astrophysics, answering the mean free path problem of why stars in a colliding galaxies never interact. I mean, how many of you think that if one galaxy bounces into another galaxy that you would have stars hitting each other? Right, show of hands. So not the kind of question a surgical pathologist answers every day, I grant you. But I chanced to ask that question one day. And it turns out that the answer is 1 in 10 to the 19 years, which is so infrequently it basically never happens. Which the analog of this in the physical space of the Galois field is that if you have a unique vector, the chance of it representing a different morphologic entity by accident are extremely unlikely. So the statistics are really in your favor for being able to use the Galois field to separate different morphologic entities. That's really all I want to say on this. This is the derivation of the genes mean free path problem. So with that as a predicate, I'd like to show you some consequences of what these tools allow for. Look at the histomine 1, 2, and 3. So as a first attempt at making this algorithm effective, it was interesting to ask a question, could we make a tool? And by we, I mean Anastasios Marcus, who is now at Atmel Corporation, and myself, that would in real time query a region of interest against an established vocabulary and look for entities which are like or dissimilar. And so as I move the cursor around, there's a region of interest around this cursor, which is looking at comparison of vectors in the VQ Galois field space. And you can see that number is constantly changing as I move the cursor around. So we were able to show that we could generate a tool that would be fast enough to support real-time generation of queries on a simple data set. The next question, of course, was could this be combined with additional features? So we looked at two features in this particular algorithm. One was looking for lymphoid aggregates. So you'll notice in this box here, this is a lymphoid aggregate box, and this is an adenocarcinoma box. This is similar to what I demonstrated last year, but we've increased the speed. And you can see the confidence ratio when there's a match. These are the confidence intervals ranging up to 100%. So you can see when I hit what's probably a central area of a lymphoid aggregate. Let's see, this one's one as well over here. We can see the confidence ratios. As I hit a malignant gland, you can see the confidence ratio goes all the way to 100%. It's found it. So this is for a local domain capabilities. And so we were able to show that it is possible to generate a tool in real time to identify matches with established categories in a vocabulary. The next question was to say, well, can we do a sweep of the entire image and then look for particular diagnostic entities? And in this case, we're looking for malignancy. Simply by pushing this button, the algorithm will now make a query of every local domain against the vocabulary and classify images based on being similar or dissimilar to adenocarcinoma. And again, as long as you've categorized and sorted your vectors ahead of time, this can be made to look for anything. So it's the predicate for the establishment of a tool for differential diagnoses. Just interestingly, then I'll conclude, this can be extended with confidence intervals. So if I say I really, really want to look for adenocarcinoma, I'm willing to make a system which is a little bit less stringency, give me everything that looks even slightly concerning, and you can see that the areas affected now increase, showing that additional vectors are allowed to match in the algorithm. So in summary, as a predicate for future tools with image-based query, when you combine vector quantization and Galois fields, you can generate tools that can actually look for specific histomorphologic entities. I have a pilot version of this algorithm. Unfortunately, it's too large to fit on a laptop, but it will be available by website, which combines this type of query with proteomic and genomic data. I will make that similarly available to Bruce Friedman within the month. It's known as HistoMine, and this will be a tool then that will be available to the public for exploration of queries where your images can be queried against the established database looking for features. And what the tool will return to you is both an image and the annotations associated with that image. And for time's consideration, I will conclude now and let Dr. Michael Feldman begin, and then we'll take questions at the end of both of our sessions. Thank you.